B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, but it feels like a Monday. May 30th, 2017, I took the long Memorial Day weekend for a road trip to Southern California to hook up with friends and family. And we're back in the saddle here with news and comment and a lot of catching up to do. First, I want to commend The Intercept for an important investigative piece, and let's name the authors, Aline Brown, Will Parrish, and Alice Sperry. And their in-depth report, it runs more than 20 pages, shows in detail, using public documents and some leaked reports, that the shutdown of the protests at Standing Rock, the water protectors at the Dakota Access Pipeline site, was busted up by an international mercenary and security firm collaborating with state and local law enforcement agencies. Police state activities, friends. And this really comprises the fundamental elements of fascism. When a corporate entity like Energy Transfer Partners can hire a company that has a history with U.S. military and State Department contractor as a mercenary and security firm, it's called Tiger Swan, and they actively colluded with the apparatus of the post-9/11 police state that we were told was erected to protect us from international terrorism, and instead is being deployed against peaceful indigenous and other American citizens who invoked their First Amendment rights to protest. Now, this is not a big surprise, but I think it is important confirmation, and I hasten to point out that this originated under the Obama administration. It's real popular now to blame Trump as a fascist and a police state wannabe. But it was Obama who sat idly by and allowed the protest to continue without intervening in a meaningful way. He did make one step to delay the approval, but that was easily thwarted when Trump came into office. And meanwhile, the suppression of the protesters ran a course very similar to the Occupy protests that were shut down through the same kind of collusion. So I've linked to The Intercept's report, and I encourage you to read every word of it. They describe how internal communications from Tiger Swan describe the movement of the protesters there as an ideologically driven insurgency with a strong religious component, and compare the anti-pipeline water protectors to jihadist fighters that they had confronted in Afghanistan. Now, we've seen the erection of this militarized law enforcement apparatus, which I believe is vertically integrated with top-down command protocols, and the militarization of local police forces, as we saw in Ferguson and many other flashpoints during the Obama administration. And I know some of my listeners are still big fans of Barack Obama, and you can't believe that he would preside over anything like this. Well, read the dirty details. Tiger Swan spearheaded a multifaceted private security operation characterized by sweeping and invasive surveillance of protesters. Yes, they infiltrated the water protectors, and they also liaised, as government people like to say. They colluded, they interacted with the FBI, Homeland Security, Justice Department, the Marshals Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, as well as the state and local police. The helicopter flights daily were paid for by the Energy Transfer Partners corporate interests, operated by Tiger Swan, and they shared their videos with the cops and everybody else. This is similar to the Pinkerton crackdown on labor unions that occurred back in the 1920s and 30s in this country. And it is the most odious form of the public-private partnership, and we'll talk about another one of those in a couple of minutes here. So this is something that I, as you can tell, am very exercised about. I believe that Americans looked at Barack Obama, said he's smart, he knows how to run the White House and manage the presidency, he doesn't elbow foreign leaders out of the way at photo ops. But he presided over the what I call the permanent police state that we thought was just temporary because of the hysteria after 9/11. But Obama made sure that the surveillance state run by the NSA was regularized, normalized, legalized in most respects. And these efforts to crack down on First Amendment activists are a signature of the Obama years. But many people are in denial about that. Now, going back to Labor Day weekend last year, 2016, you may remember Democracy Now! Was there, and Amy was temporarily detained for covering this public newsworthy event. And so it was after the Labor Day incident where pipeline security guards used attack dogs, who had no tags, by the way. And in the aftermath of that, Energy Transfer Partners turned to Tiger Swan, a company with a deep background in counterterrorism operations, to oversee the work of the other security companies that were already there, including Silverton, Russell Group of Texas, Ten Code LLC, Permar, I've never heard of any of these people, SRC, OnPoint, and Layton. So there was an army of private security firms headed by this defense contractor, Tiger Swan. And Tiger Swan was created by a retired Army colonel, James Reese, during the height of the war in Iraq. And the records that were obtained by The Intercept show that Tiger Swan operated without a license in North Dakota. They were asked to apply for one, and it appears that they never actually did. But who cares, you know? Protesters need permits, not the armies of private contractors. And this is, I believe, the most serious issue we face domestically is the creep of police state activities. And part of the operation of Tiger Swan was to smear the protesters, the water protectors, by suggesting that they were violent, could become violent, and other lies that were pumped out into the corporate media and into social media. I hope that people will recognize that Obama created this monster, and it's now under the control of Trump, Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions, and a lot of other odious people. So the latest fact-free, leak-based report of the Trump-Russia investigation and scandal popped up on Friday from the Washington Post. And the reports, which cannot be confirmed, says the New York Times, were nevertheless dutifully repeated in the New York Times. And that becomes two sources for the same unsourced, unverified, leak-based report. And I'm sorry to keep invoking this litany of descriptors, but we have a real problem here. Before I go into the details here, I want to invoke the law of cantilever. Now, a few years ago, one of our decks started to lean, and as we replaced it, we figured out that the people who built our house had not observed the law of cantilever. And that is, if you're going to have a deck or some other structure that sticks out, juts out from the main building, the beams that support it have to be twice as long as the unsupported overhang. Otherwise, the law of cantilever will bite you, and your structure will crumble. And that's what I thought of as I wasn't sleeping earlier this morning, and processing all of this information that has been pouring out that remains evidence-free, and it's certainly damning to Trump and to Kushner and to the entire transition team and the people who now populate the White House. And it does put the Trump presidency at graver risk than it was even a week ago. But this is a report that is based on three people. We don't know their names. They don't have the balls to go public and tell us what they know. But these three people say that there was this bizarre meeting at Trump Tower between Jared Kushner and the Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak, and that Kislyak was alarmed, was shocked, when Trump's son-in-law said, hey, we want to set up a back channel, a secret way that we can communicate with Putin that will not be interceptable by American intelligence agencies, who we know Trump distrusts. Now, this is certainly inflammatory. It is alarming. And if it can be proved, and we learn the actual motive for this alleged activity, this can be sharply damaging to Kushner himself and to Trump, who presumably knew about this and ordered it. What were they trying to get to Putin that they couldn't allow American intelligence agencies to intercept? And why on earth did they believe that there was such a channel? Well, they felt that the only channel that might be available is a Russian channel, and the idea was that an American representative of the Trump team would go to a Russian secure facility like an embassy and be able to relay a message to Vladimir Putin. The whole thing is pretty bizarre to me. But I have to stress that this is based on leaks and unproven allegations. So let me quote from the New York Times, which quotes the Washington Post. The Post reported that the direct line between the transition team and the Kremlin in concept would have been conducted through Russian diplomatic facilities to avoid being monitored in American communication systems. The Post also reported that Kushner had proposed the communications channel and that it took Kislyak by surprise. The New York Times could not immediately confirm these details, end quote, but they goddamn reported anyway. And this I spoke about last week. There's only one set of sources for this information. But once it's reported by multiple outlets, they back each other up, and it creates the impression, the illusion, that this is solid, credible reporting. Now, in coverage that I caught up with last night on the boob tube, the Washington Post later on Friday acknowledged that the basis for this originally was an anonymous letter they received last December, and it took them until about now to corroborate it to their satisfaction. But we still don't know what the actual discussions were, and I have a large suspicion that a Russian, possibly Kislyak, was the original source of the anonymous letter that was sent to the Washington Post. And if that's true, and of course I am speculating, I want to be clear about that, then it shows that Trump et al. Placed far too much confidence or faith, trust, in the Russians. Now, the other news that's dribbled out is that there were more phone calls between Kushner and Kislyak than originally reported. Kushner didn't report many of these on his security clearance application, and Democrats are rightly calling for a review of his security clearance and status. But here's the follow-up story published today in the New York Times. Again, listen to the language in this opening paragraph and ask yourself, what evidence is this based on? I'll quote the entire paragraph. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, was looking for a direct line to Vladimir Putin of Russia, a search that in mid-December found him in a room with a Russian banker whose financial institution was deeply intertwined with Russian intelligence and remains under sanction by the United States. What evidence do you base on this now statement of fact that Kushner, quote, was looking for a direct line to President Putin? Journalism has gotten way off track here. And I'm not saying this to defend Trump in any way. Because hopefully at some point, in the not-too-distant future, we're going to see the smoke screen fade away. And actual evidence and people with names will be there to say, oh yeah, this is what I know and this is how I know it and this is why we are claiming, for example, that Russia interfered to help Trump in the election. So this latest report is about a Russian banker named Gorkov. He runs a bank that is almost impossible to pronounce in English. But he is not seen as somebody who is that close to Putin or has ever performed these kind of cloak and dagger diplomatic missions before. So let me quote this next paragraph from today's article in the New York Times, because they don't bother to say that they haven't been able to confirm this shit. On Friday, citing American officials briefed on intelligence reports, the Post reported that Kislyak told his superiors in Moscow that Kushner had proposed a secret channel and had suggested using Russian diplomatic facilities in the U.S. for the communications. Now, the White House has not denied the Post report. That doesn't make it true. And so the Times has even decided that they no longer need to tag this by saying that they couldn't confirm what the Post has reported. It is now treated as fact, and it just took the holiday weekend and some barbecued burgers to solidify that. So we'll see where all this goes, but that is the latest that I've been able to pick up. Today, Trump has been tweeting a report that Fox did at the behest of Kellyanne Conway, saying that the Russians suggested the back channel. I don't know. That, of course, becomes a non-denial of the back channel subject. But we're still untethered here, adrift on the high seas, without any real anchor in terms of facts or known sources. We're told that there's going to be a shakeup at the White House, and the first to go is a guy we've never heard of, Michael Dubke, who's described as the White House communications director for the last 3 months. Never heard of the guy. But he is jumping ship, possibly before he gets pushed. We were also told on Friday that on his return from his elbow-jabbing trip to Europe and the Middle East, that his lawyers were going to take control of Trump's Twitter account and only allow vetted tweets, heavily vetted, I mean really heavily vetted tweets, to go public. But Trump's been at it over the weekend. And today he tweeted, the U.S. Senate should switch to 51 votes immediately and get health care and tax cuts approved fast and easy. Dems would do it, no doubt. Well, they didn't when they controlled the Senate, Donnie. And we don't even have confirmation that the House bill that repealed and replaced Obamacare with a joke is actually in the Senate so far. It may have been moved up over the last few days, but I haven't seen confirmation of that. And the Times corrects the president's tweet. Mr. Trump's message made clear he does not understand procedures that the Senate is operating under. His health care bill pending in the Senate is being considered under rules that don't allow a filibuster and only require 51 votes, but the Republicans can't even get the 51 votes. And I didn't have room for it today, but hopefully tomorrow we'll cover how Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has publicly acknowledged that he doesn't have the votes because there are three senators who will peel off if the replacement of Obamacare actually gives decent health insurance options to people. And there are three votes who won't participate unless it kills the entire thing and drowns it in a bathtub. And so we may have this problem where the House bill will become an orphan. The people who voted for it may pay a price at the next election. But in the meantime, the Affordable Care Act and the insurance that it provides will internally crumble as the Republicans cheer it on, and we'll be left with a whole lot of nothing. It's really bizarre. They are unable to complete what they started, and they shouldn't have started it, knowing what they knew. Over the weekend, there was one voice, actually two voices, General Mattis, the National Security Advisor, and General Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security, they came to the defense of Jared Kushner saying, well, you know, it's a good idea to have channels of communication open to anybody. I mean, it's just blather. But also Kelly, appearing on Fox News Sunday, warns that there may be a ban on laptop computers carried into the cabin on flights to and from Europe and the Middle East. This would expand the partial ban on devices larger than a smartphone allowed in the cabin on direct flights between the U.S. and 8 majority Muslim countries. And they're not telling us what the actual threat is, but the idea that the, you know, say a laptop computer is safer in the baggage hold than it is in the cabin is really questionable. Because of the lithium-ion batteries that many computers have, the risk of fire in the baggage hold appears to be far higher than a case where a terrorist is able to dummy up a computer and make it into a bomb and get it into the cabin of an airliner. And of course, there's also the possibility that a shrewd terrorist could dummy up the computer, put it in checked baggage, and have a way to detonate it from the cabin or from the ground. And this is part of the bizarre airport security theater that we have been enduring for far too long, friends. It doesn't make us any safer. And coming up shortly, we'll talk about some of the risks that lead to actual terrorist behavior, like in Manchester, England. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who generously support my podcast with your subscriptions. People like Joey Perillo, the famous actor from Philly, Tim McKay, Janet Price, and Wendy Gebauer. They're all monthly subscribers, and I invite you to join them. In fact, I could use your help today. So come on over to peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, click on it, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page where the bonus books are on display. And if you take out a new annual subscription for $50 and give me a mailing address here in the continental U.S., one of those bonus books can be yours. David Dayan writes for The Intercept, and he has confirmed a story that I first tipped you to last week based on a journalist source of mine. And that is that in the happy kingdom of Saudi Arabia, when Trump and his crew visited, we had not only the arms deal, $110 billion, not only the kickback to Ivanka, $100 million, but also a plan to support infrastructure development in the United States, rebuilding bridges and building new public facilities, that we would be part of one of these P3s, a public-private partnership. And as I tipped you last week, I am very, very skeptical of these deals. But the Saudi kingdom is joining forces with a Trump crony to build a $40 billion war chest to privatize U.S. infrastructure. So you got a bridge that's falling down? The Saudis and the fine people at Blackstone, run by Stephen Schwarzman, who was appointed by Trump to the Strategic and Policy Forum, well, Blackstone is going to leverage the $20 billion provided by the Saudis and get involved in these infrastructure deals. And this is just riddled with cronyism and corruption and conflicts of interest. Schwarzman in particular gave $4 million to super PACs that supported Trump in the election cycle last year. And the Blackstone Group is one of the largest lenders to the Kushner family, Jared Kushner's family, more than $400 million in loans since 2013. And so this is just so incestuous. And here's a quote from a public interest guy, Jeff Hauser, of the Revolving Door Project. Donald Trump brokering a deal between Saudi royalty and private equity magnates associated with both the Republican and Democratic parties is about as much corruption and self-dealing as can be squeezed into a single sentence. And Democrats are kind of dismissive of Trump's infrastructure plan, which really is no plan. We don't have any details. If there were a list of facilities and bridges and rail lines that were, you know, targeted for these investments, and we could see where the money's going to go and who's going to own it and who's going to extract rents or tolls from it after the project is completed, we might have a better picture. But right now, it's just this vague notion that Trump's going to rebuild America with Saudi money managed by his good buddies. And they might just take a little teeny-weeny profit there, don't you think? Just a little? And here's another crony deal that has not been reported in the corporate media. I credit our scrappy investigative reporter Steve Horn at the Smog Blog. And by looking at tweets from the Saudi press agency's English language account, he figured out that last week, despite the fact that Rexxon Tillerson, the former head of ExxonMobil, who's playing Secretary of State in the Trump reality show, he said he'd recuse himself from anything that had anything to do with his former company. But there he was in Saudi Arabia after his successor at Exxon, Darren Woods, negotiated a deal with the Saudi, Basic Industries Corporation. And they are exploring a $10 billion plant to be built on the Gulf of Mexico. And this is another sordid deal, because Tillerson was there shaking hands with the CEO of the Saudi Basic Industries Corporation and his successor, whose name is Darren Woods, and the Saudi Defense Minister, Prince Bin Salman. Trump is seen seated in the background of the photos. So this is a new era of cronyism and brazen shakedowns. Trump takes the kids with him wherever he goes so that they can set up deals to profiteer from his presidency and his buddy. Now he's his buddy. He never knew Rex Tillerson before he named him as Secretary of State. It is just so bizarre. I want to credit Jim Cavanaugh at Counterpunch for a very important analysis of what happened and why it happened in Manchester last week. Because the 22-year-old young man who blew himself up was the son of a Libyan family that was allowed to return to Libya in 2011 during the takedown of Gaddafi that was driven by Britain, the United States, and France, advocated by Hillary Clinton, approved by Barack Obama. And so the Abadi family were not accidental byproducts, but deliberately incubated protégés of American, British, French, NATO regime change in Libya, a project executed by the Obama administration and spearheaded by Hillary Clinton. I've linked to the article so you can read the full analysis for yourselves, but I think it's a very important point. And, of course, you won't see it in the corporate media. But you did see clips from Hillary Clinton's rousing speech to the graduates at Wellesley, her alma mater, where she labeled me and others a third-party crazy, and while saying that things didn't go exactly the way she had planned in the election last year, she offered no mention of Libya, no mention of her blunders in the campaign last year, no mention of her arrogance that she insisted on running for president even though she had committed unforced errors, as they say in tennis, like the Clinton Foundation sordid aroma and the ongoing scandal over her emails. And she even flubbed by saying that, without naming Trump, predicting that he would be impeached, because she talked about Nixon, and, you know, she was a low-level staffer on the impeachment committee, the Watergate committee back in the 70s. Referring to Nixon, she said his presidency, Trump's presidency will eventually end in disgrace with his impeachment for obstruction of justice. Nixon was not actually impeached. He resigned when he saw that the votes were there to achieve that. The new leader of France, President Emmanuel Macron, held a meeting with Putin at the Palace of Versailles. And if you've ever been there, that is such a spectacular place. And the occasion was the commemoration of a meeting between Peter the Great and his French counterpart back in 1717. And Macron worked both sides. He praised Putin and Russia, saying that they are an important player on the world stage today. But he also surprised many by very bluntly blaming Russia Today and Sputnik for what he considered to be nefarious deeds during the French election. And he said that Russia Today and Sputnik have been organs of influence during this campaign, which on many occasions produced untruths about me and my campaign, and so I determined that they had no place. I confirm it in my headquarters. So I guess he's saying that they are banned from the French government facilities as he takes office in the next few weeks. But that is a pretty strong statement on his part, and of course it dovetails with a lot of the reporting here in the United States of alleged Russian interference in our elections. But we still don't have evidence of the nature. As you may know, Macron's campaign was badly hacked just a few hours before the 24-hour silent period before the election. But he won nevertheless. Angela Merkel gave a speech at a beer hall in Munich. I think it was in Munich on Sunday. And she said that it was in Munich. I can confirm that. She didn't mention Trump by name. I guess people are afraid to. They think that will cause the insecure one to tweet away. But what she said was that she had just experienced in the last few days that the Europeans must take our fate into our own hands. A clear suggestion that they can't rely on Trump or the United States anymore. And this, of course, repudiates the decades of history since World War II. And it's sad that Trump feels that his ego and his idea of America first have to trample on the interests of our key allies. And Merkel was too polite to mention that Europe's refugee crisis, and Germany has taken in over 1 million refugees, is a direct cause of American misadventures in the Middle East. They wouldn't have a refugee problem and these terrorist attacks in Europe if the U.S. had not invaded Afghanistan, Iraq, and participated in the mess in Syria. And Germany's Der Spiegel News magazine published an editorial calling Trump a laughingstock and a danger to the world. On Friday, the Federal Appeals Court based in Virginia ruled against the Trump administration in a 10-3 vote. This is what's called an en banc appeal. They skip the stage where a three-judge panel reviews it, and then it can be appealed up to the full court. And they flatly rejected the travel decree part 2. Saying that it speaks with vague words of national security, but in context it drips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination. The aforementioned Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions says that the Trump team will appeal this to the Supreme Court. Of course, one of the key elements was suspending the immigration for 120 days of any refugees from anywhere in the world. And what's interesting is, on the same day, we're told this is completely unrelated to the court ruling, the State Department quietly notified countries around the world that they can resume sending refugees to the United States. They lifted the restriction on the number allowed to enter each month. The quotas on refugee resettlement were largely the result of budget constraints imposed by Congress in the temporary spending measure last fall, but when they passed a spending bill this month to fund the government for the rest of the fiscal year, it didn't include any restrictions on refugee administrations. I wonder if the staff did this while Rexon was over in Saudi Arabia and Europe trying to clean up the doo-doo left behind by his boss. And speaking of immigration, there was a scuffle and threats of gun violence on the floor of the House of Representatives in the state of Texas in Austin the other day. Hundreds of protesters were there, it was yesterday, Monday, at the state capitol, opposing a new bill that would ban sanctuary communities or sanctuary policies anywhere in the state of Texas. And a Republican whose name is Rinaldi, I'm trying to get his first name here, but I don't see it, Matt Rinaldi, he said, "This is BS, because the protesters were disrupting the proceedings. And there were people there who appeared to be brown who carried signs which said, 'I'm illegal and I'm here to stay.' So Matt Rinaldi called the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people to come to the State House and arrest these protesters. And Democratic Representative Pancho Navarez, who represents a border town, got into a scuffle with Rinaldi. We don't have his side of the story. But Rinaldi says Navarez threatened my life on the House floor after I called ICE on several illegal immigrants. And he claims that he was threatening gun violence to protect himself." And the sob story for an immigrant today comes from Minnesota, where a man who was riding the light rail near Minneapolis on May 14th was picked up by a transit cop for failing to pay his fare. And while he was interacting with Ariel Vences Lopez, the officer asked, and this was captured by a fellow traveler on a camera phone, "Are you here illegally?" And that is a flat violation of the law in Minneapolis, because they passed a sanctuary law in 2003 that forbids law enforcement from asking that question. Now, we're told that the transit cop also used a taser on the suspect for refusing orders to sit down. And the officer, whose name is not clear, is described as no longer an employee of the transit police. Justice delayed, but nevertheless, it has arrived in Cleveland almost 3 years after 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot dead by a cop who approached and asked no questions, did no investigation, just shot Tamir because he had a toy gun and was playing by himself in a park near the apartment where his family lived. And there was a grand jury that refused to bring charges against any of the officers back in 2015. And to its credit, the city did pursue an internal disciplinary process, and the cop has been fired. And we wrap up today with two obituaries. I don't do a lot of obituaries, but I do think it's important to note when certain people pass away. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who gave a lot of bad advice to Jimmy Carter as National Security Advisor. He had succeeded Henry Kissinger, and I refer to Brzezinski as the Democratic Kissinger. He was most responsible for the attempted rescue of the embassy hostages in Tehran, and launching the disastrous operation that failed to free them. He was also responsible for the covert operations in Afghanistan, where we hired Osama bin Laden and other people called the Mujahideen to make life difficult for the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the blowback for which we are still experiencing. And another notorious figure from the 1980s has passed away. Manuel Noriega died at the age of 83 in Panama City the other day. He was a CIA asset, a wily guy who appeared to use the cocaine that was transshipped through his country. I guess he took more than a cash kickback. But at the same time that he was a U.S. asset, he was also selling Panamanian passports to Cubans, to the Cuban government, for use by their spies. So he was an unreliable guy who played all sides, and in an effort to burnish his reelection opportunity, In 92, George H.W. Bush, during the Christmas period of 1989, invaded Panama and removed Manuel Noriega. He was tried in Miami, he served a long sentence in the U.S., and then was returned to Panama to serve additional prison sentences. And he was our guy. And the idea that it took a military invasion to go in there and grab him and take him out of power and install somebody more friendly to the United States, or at least more consistently friendly to the United States, it was seen as this heroic maneuver by Poppy Bush. And it was next to the invasion of Grenada by Ronald Reagan, the dumbest military action by the United States in my lifetime. We're going to give Roy Rogers the day off today and serenade you with a Capital Steps song about the invasion of Panama. Yes, we need a little isthmus. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Well, you know, I've tried to keep busy in the White House with the horseshoe pit and Barbara and the grandkids and everything, but golly, somehow, something just seems to be missing. Oh, golly.
George, do what presidents have always done. Call out the army. You need a brand new war to lift your spirits up.
That won't alarm me. But do you think we should send troops to Panama now?
George, you need a little isthmus right this very minute. Give Manuel the business. If you now begin it, we could all be home by Christmas. We might even win it.
Kick Manuel right in the fanny. Send a force that's led by Danny.
Tell Noriega I'm gonna raid him like I Tanti raided that by Delta Mega.
Wear your combat ribbons from the National Guard.
Yes, we need a little isthmus. So many months we waited. The army told us this must be better than Grenada. No more peaceful coexistence. Danny will invade it.
I'll be just like Patton.
Brush up on your Latin.
Send him to the isthmus.
Just what nation is this?
Need a name.